Before today's episode, we're delighted to announce that Gidon Levy, who was just awarded Israel's highest journalistic prize, the Sokolov Prize, will be joining us next week for an Ask Me Anything session. Many congratulations to Gidon from all of us at Haaretz Weekly, and the email address to submit questions appears in the program notes of this episode. Hello and welcome to Haaretz Weekend, a glossy audio supplement on Israel, the Middle East and the Jewish world. I'm Simon Spungin. On today's show... After a dramatic, fateful and historic week here in Israel, when a new government was sworn in, ultranationalist thugs chanted death to Arabs in Jerusalem, and incendiary balloons from Gaza caused fires in southern Israel, we're going to engage in some good old-fashioned escapism on this episode of Haaretz Weekend. Food, music and television are on the menu today as we take a deep breath and dive gratefully into the weekend. In a little while, I'll be talking to Shana Oppenheimer, who, together with Daniel de Lima Guri, wrote a fascinating article about Tide the Goat, an 18-year-old rapper from the Black Hebrew community in Dimona who is facing deportation from Israel. We'll be back with us to talk about a streaming platform that's bringing the rich world of Israeli television to North American screens, with subtitles. Today's main course, however, is Shani Litman, who writes for Haaretz about culture, literature, and television. Before we talk to our first guest, however, just a little reminder that you can subscribe not only to this podcast, but also to Haaretz.com to get complete, unfettered, and ad-free access to all of Haaretz's superb round-the-clock news, analysis, and opinion. And now, on with the show. Next month, we'll see the launch of ASIF, the Culinary Institute of Israel, the first such organization dedicated to exploring, tasting, and celebrating Israel's complex and often controversial culinary world. I'm joined now by Haaretz's Shani Litman, who met with the founder of ASIF, Naama Shefi, and whose interview with her is now up on the website. Shani, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
First things first, Shani, and I understand that this is something that ASIF is well aware of. What is Israeli food? Is there such a thing?
Well, they insist there is such a thing. The definition of Israeli food is obviously complicated, and that's exactly what they are trying to do. They're trying to explore and, as you said, celebrate, which is a word that repeated many times in the interview with Naama Shefi. I think maybe it's a way to be very pluralist about it, just to say, okay, there are many things that are... Israeli food is something that it is hard to define, but there are so many influences on it. And, well, we're trying to not to decide, but to ask the question and to bring as many possibilities as possible and, investigating it.
Mm. Most cuisines are melting pots. I suppose that's a very apt cliche for when we're talking about. But Israeli cuisine in particular, right? Not just the native foods that were found in Israel and across the Middle East that have been imported here, but also the immigrants that bring foods from wherever they come.
Yes, exactly. And I think it's complicated to define what an Israeli food is because it's difficult to define what Israel is or what is Israeli. Like, you know, we have this question that Yair Lapid used to ask in his talk show. What do you find Israeli? What is Israeli? Mm. So, Naama said that, well, first of all, of course, the regional food, which is also Arab and Palestinian and Middle Eastern, is a big influence on the local cuisine. And then we have all the influences that came with the different kitchens that came with the Jews from different countries. So it's maybe we are in the middle of it's a process. We're not yet there, but you can already point certain institutions as a very Israeli, like she mentioned the Israeli breakfast. That is something that started in the kibbutzim. The idea of culinary culture didn't exist yet, but they already had this big breakfast because they needed a lot of energy to go to the field and work. And that became a very Israeli thing. Like you have now in every restaurant or a cafe in Israel, you have this Israeli breakfast.
Which is?
You have, of course, a salad with many vegetables and boiled egg or scrambled eggs. And then you have all kind of cheese and bread, of course. It's more than we eat in other countries, I mean, for breakfast. It's a big breakfast.
Maybe you haven't had a full English breakfast. That's probably a different experience.
Yeah, it's different because Israelis, they like to eat a lot of vegetables. Mm-hmm. And, well, English breakfast doesn't really have. I mean, unless potatoes, you consider it as vegetables, which
and fried tomatoes, maybe.
And fried yeah, but the eating fresh vegetables is one of the main characteristics of the Israeli kitchen, and of course the Israeli breakfast.
Now, I said that celebrating Israeli cuisine can be controversial. If you want to start an argument on Facebook, you just say that falafel is Israeli.
Yes.
And even though it might be Israel's national dish, I don't remember, for example, Americans being accused of culturally appropriating the pizza, which has become one of America's national dishes.
Yes.
How does Asif intend to overcome this landmine?
Well, they're trying to, as Naama told me, for them it's very important to include also the Palestinian kitchen and Palestinian chefs and culinary experts in their activities and research, because they also they intend to do many researches. They also have a very big library. And she's actually looking for a person, a Palestinian kitchen expert that will work there. I don't know if she already, if she found it already, but she said that it was a little bit difficult to find people to work with. Some of the professionals actually didn't want to cooperate with them because they felt that, again, as you said, it's a question of appropriation. I mean, Israeli kitchen tend to appropriate sometimes some of the Palestinian dishes and not giving the right credit.
Tell us a little about Naama Shefi herself. Some of our listeners might know of a previous project that Naama was involved in, the Jewish Food Society.
Yeah.
What was that?
Well, Naama lives in New York for over 15 years now. She started as a film director. She went there to study cinema. Food was always very important for her, even though she was born and raised in a kibbutz, which is, you know, as we did talk about the Israeli breakfast, but in general, kibbutzim are not culinarily...
Right. No, nobody goes there for the experience,
yeah,
for the Michelin star.
For the food. So she went to New York, and then she realized that through the culture of food and kitchen and cooking, you can also find your identity or define it in a way. Or it's a way to reach your identity, a Jewish identity. And so she opened this institution called the Jewish Food Society, which it started as a website. She collected recipes from Jewish grandmothers, recipes that she wanted to save or preserve as an archive of recipes. And now she's working with five women in her crew, and they're going into the grandmother's house. Sometimes it's in Israel, sometimes it's in the United States, even in Brazil and other countries. And they cook with them. They learn the recipe, then they go back to their kitchen in New York, they improve the recipe, and they make this table, and they photograph it. It's a lot about, I think, it's research and also design. For her, it's very important, the visual side of it.
So, oh, it's a beautiful website. Yeah. I was looking at some of the recipes there
and
bookmarked a couple of them for when I'm feeling more adventurous in the kitchen.
They also have different events, talks, meetings with different people. They also have a podcast, of course, as we all do today.
And will Asif be doing some similar things for Israeli cuisine?
Yeah. They're going to have a lot of events supposed to be open to the public. I was a little bit skeptical about, you know, in Israel, everything that related to the kitchen becomes very, or to restaurants or to food becomes very expensive.
Yeah.
especially in Tel Aviv. So I was a bit skeptical about that, and I asked her. She insisted that it's supposed to be something affordable for everybody, even if they have a pop-up dinner with some chef from abroad or from Israel or whatever. You know, we will have to wait and see. It's a research center. It's a cultural center. It's a library. It's many things. But I think the idea behind it was to promote Israeli kitchen in Israel and abroad.
Mm. Shani, I'm not much of a consumer of reality television, mm-hmm. Shani, but I do know that every single Israeli channel has at least one cook-off show, MasterChef, The
Absolutely.
Greatest Chef, everything. What is it about these shows?
Yeah, I just watched yesterday. There's a new one, Dessert Reality, The Perfect Dessert.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, it was hard to watch. I try to understand what it is. I think, well, you know, in Israel, I think even before the reality, the cooking reality, the kitchen is the center of the house. Mm. You know, that's a very Middle Eastern thing. It's a Jewish thing. So it became also an Israeli thing. Even for me, you know, I feel that if I'm not cooking dinner to my family, then I'm not a good enough mother. So I try to do that maybe once a week. As Nama also said, we are a cooking nation, so they relate to this show. Mm. Also, I think they pick these chefs that are the jury of those shows. They are very charismatic people, so it also works. Mm.
And Israelis also like a bit of cutthroat competition, don't they?
Yeah, so, exactly. Yeah. And also, it's a way of approaching and avoiding in the same time all the complex questions, like, as we said before, mm-hmm. you know, Arabs, Israelis, religious, non-religious, different cultures, Mizrahim, Ashkenazim. In those shows, you see everything and in a light way. Mm. So,
listen, Shani, you asked Nama this question, so it's only fair that I ask you the same thing. What's your favorite Israeli food?
I asked her what is her favorite food. I didn't ask about Israeli food.
And she surprised you by saying herring.
Herring, yeah.
Okay, there's no accounting for taste.
Herring is nice. My favorite, I think my favorite food is, well, I'm a bit embarrassed to say because it's really, it's like a child.
It's all right, nobody's listening.
Well, I can say one thing about Israeli food, which is also, I don't know, Arab food, Israeli food. I don't like lemon in the salad, which creates many problems.
Are you really Israeli?
Yeah. Yeah, you see, and I don't like hummus that much. So, yeah, I find myself in very awkward situations because of that. And I love corn, mm-hmm. which is, it probably related to the fact that my parents came from Romania. You know, they mm-hmm. make mamaliga, which is this. But I also have a very refined taste sometimes, so...
Well, as far as I'm concerned, you could stop making all Israeli food apart from Kubane, and I would be happy.
But Kubane is Yemenite.
Yemenite, Israeli. There's enough Kubane to go around.
It's very complicated. Can we think of a real Israeli, like a new dish that we can say is very Israeli? She mentioned schnitzel in pita mm-hmm. with chips and harissa and... Yeah, that's
the combination of the Viennese schnitzel, which is usually made out of veal, but adapted for Israel, and then stuffed in a pita bread. It's quintessentially Israeli.
But I love salad, like a vegetable, fresh vegetable salad, which I would not call Israeli because it's, you know, it's also Palestinian.
I don't know about you, but all of this food talk has made me kind of hungry. Is it too early to pop over to Falafel, Gina? I think it probably is. We're
you
recording
like falafel?
This.
That's your favorite?
No, not my favorite, but if you put enough amber on it, I'm happy.
Okay.
Shani, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Shabbat shalom.
Shabbat shalom.
Listener, stay with us. After this jingle, I'll be chatting with Shana Oppenheimer about Tide the Goat, the black Hebrew rapper from Dimona. So we're going back to a story that we covered a few weeks ago here on Haaretz Weekly, the Israeli government's rather sudden and seemingly arbitrary decision to deport a group of 100 members of the Black Hebrew Israelite community. As Judy Maltz told us at the time, many of those slated for deportation were born here, and some even served in the IDF. Since then, there's been a lively campaign on social media and in real life against the decision. One of the most poignant voices in that campaign is a rapper called Gavrielle Smith. You went down to Dimona to meet Smith, whose nom de rap is Tied the Goat. So let's hear some of his music, shall we?
Yeah. It's a lot of change around here, man. I swear to God, this shit tough, bro. Yeah. I remember sweeping for a buck. Now I'm popping in these hoes, I wanna fuck. I asked for help and everybody acting stuck. Put it on my family, I swear I was out of luck. Dripping in some green just cause I'm all about a buck. You be sipping lean, I got some Henny in my cup. Gang gon' slap for me, they rap for me no matter what. Would you rap for me? She say, hell yeah, just give it up. Gang just caught a case, he was in the way, so now he fuck. Bro was on that block and he got shot, man, that was tough. Long live everybody who died on them pavements. Promise I'ma get to that bag we was chasing. Killing niggas just cause of jealousy, why you hatin'? God forbid that one of my niggas ended up changing. It's a stranger. How family turning to strangers.
I've got to say, I wasn't expecting that. I was expecting something a lot angrier. I found that very uplifting, especially given the violence and negativity that Gavrielle says he experiences the moment he steps out of his own community. Did he sound angry when you were talking to him, Shana, about the discrimination he's experienced or the deportation decision itself?
No, not really. I think first it's worth remembering that Gavrielle is 18, right? So while he's extremely young for his age, he is still new and pretty early on in his music career. He did tell us that he is really wanting to touch on more serious topics and get into what it's like living in Dimona, what it's like living in the Black Hebrew Israelite community. But I think that at this point, this is what he's done, and it's quite impressive already for an 18-year-old. And I think we'll continue to see him mature through his music and find his voice there. And I think something that really stood out to me in our conversations with Gavrielle, and it also really broke my heart to hear, was kind of him talking about how much he really sees his life here and his home here, and that he doesn't want to leave Israel. And he expressed fear to go back to the U.S. and be a Black man in America. And while living in Israel as a minority obviously has its hardships and difficulties, and it's not pleasant. I think to see someone who already suffers discrimination from the state of Israel be so fearful of police brutality in America, it was really hard to talk about and listen to his stories and to have him express his fears.
How long has he been here?
He's been here since he was 10. He's now 18. Mm-hmm. So about 8 years. And even though that doesn't seem like a lot at that age, it's his whole life.
Well, those are the formative years.
Of course.
The community defines itself as Hebrews, right? Not Jewish. How does that coexist with being a person of color in the Jewish state?
I mean, I can't speak to that experience because it's not something I've experienced myself, at least as a Black person. I can speak to what it's like to be a Jew of color in Israel, and it's very unpleasant for a lot of reasons. But in the kind of mixing of identities of Jewish and Hebrew and Israelite, it is very interesting, I think, in terms of how the Black Hebrew Israelite community sees itself in Israel. I think there's a lot of similarities in their identity towards the Jewish religion and as Israeli. And I think they're very clear that they're Hebrew, right? And they're not so much Jewish. So that kind of came from the idea that they originated from the spiritual descendants of the ancient tribe of Judah. And the connection is historical and not necessarily religious, though there are a lot of religious elements and Jewish elements to their lifestyle.
I get the feeling that a lot of Israelis get confused between the black Hebrews with their symbols of Judaism, or what they would call Hebrew symbols from ancient times, and say that the Rastafari, who have adopted similar language and pining for Zion and so on. But this is not the case. And music has always been very central to the black Hebrew community in Israel, right?
Yeah, it has. I mean, basically in the 70s and 80s, they had this band called the Soul Messengers. And at this point, the community wasn't really well known to the public and it wasn't really established. So this group went and they toured Israel and they performed for free for the army and for other things, for bar mitzvahs and stuff. And I think this is how Israelis kind of got their first introduction to the community. And I still think very much this society is unfamiliar with this community, but this was their first introduction through music. And when I spoke to Ahmed El Ben Yehuda, who's the Minister of Information for the Black Hebrew Israelite community, he really talked about how music is really, really important to their lifestyle, how music is a form of worship and praise, and kind of the historical connection to music, not just when they came here to Israel in the 60s and 70s and even the 80s, but even back to when they were in the U.S. And he had this really poignant quote. I don't know if you wanted to share it, but this
Please.
Is what I was told. I'll just read what he told me. So when working in the fields, we didn't sing about the River Gambia, the River Volta, the River Niger, from where the slave trade picked us up. We sang about the River Jordan. We didn't think about Mali, Shanghai, or Timbuktu. We thought about Jericho, Jerusalem, and Canaan's land. We thought about this land. When he said that to me, it was really moving, and I think that really encompasses their entire story of being exiled and returning, and being exiled twice over, and returning to their true homeland. And it wasn't West Africa, it's here, and I think that's so beautiful.
Historically, immigrant and minority communities have used music and entertainment in general as an entry point into broader society. Is that true of the Black Hebrews in Israel?
I think it is. I think you can really see the connection from the Soul Messengers as being a way to make inroads with the larger Israeli society. How successful that was, I don't really know. But I think in a lot of cases, music, art, whatever, it's always the arts that act as a bridge between groups to understand each other.
I think a lot of Israelis, when you say Black Hebrews, will immediately think of Eddie Butler, who famously represented Israel in the Eurovision some years ago. Rap isn't exactly the first musical genre that you'd think about when someone mentions a spiritual group like the Black Hebrews. Soul, funk, gospel, for sure, but less so rap. Has the whole community in Dimona embraced this evolution to rap music?
I think they have. I think obviously it's not fair to say that every musician in Dimona is a rapper
now. Of course.
But, you know, when we went down to Dimona and we spoke to members of the community, you really get the sense that music is an integral part of growing up there. They kind of describe it as almost like an after school activity. And, you know, some people take a more serious road with that activity and they want to pursue it professionally. So just as the Soul Messengers in the 70s and 80s were like the signature band in the community, I think as time changes, as we see now, rap is the thing, and rap is reflecting how these young musicians, not all of them, but some of them, are wanting to express themselves.
And it is quite a symbiotic relationship because, as you mentioned in the article, some very famous American rappers have taken up the Black Hebrews cause, right?
Yeah, of course. I think that, you know, most people weren't too familiar with the Black Hebrew Israelite community or their story or their history, I think. And it was really Kendrick Lamar and I think his album Damn, where he really brought attention to this community and the flight and the story and the exile.
And bringing that story to a broader audience in the States, maybe Tied the Goat is going to do something similar here in Israel.
Yeah, it's interesting that, you know, here some rappers within the community choose to rap in English and some choose to rap in Hebrew, and it seems like a very personal choice. But when they do rap in English, I think it's very interesting because, at least from Tied the Goat or Gabriel's music, you can't really tell where he is. And when he matures in his music and starts to talk more about his identity, whether or not that will be specific to Israel or more of a universal Black Hebrew Israelite message will be interesting to see.
And you said in the article as well, and before we came on air, you were saying that the video looked like it could have been shot in any inner city America.
Yeah, and that's what really struck me. I think the first thing that really pulled me into this story is that you look at this video and you're like, wow, this could be in Chicago or Los Angeles or wherever, and you listen to what he's saying and it's kind of the same thing, and then you get more into the story and, you know, there are members of the community all over the U.S. and maybe in other places of the world, I'm not so sure about that, but it seems like being here is so specific to that narrative. So it's really interesting to see the way in which artists choose to talk about this or choose not to talk about this.
How does Gabrielle and the other members of the community plan to fight the deportation?
So people have told us that this is a very communal battle in the sense that individuals aren't fighting this alone and the community is really fighting this together. So the deportation notices have been challenged legally, and although some of the deportation notices have already expired, I don't think anyone has left yet, and I don't think anyone is planning to get on a plane, nor do I think that the government is going to send buses and take people to Ben Gurion Airport and make them get on a plane. It's worth mentioning that while the letters did kind of come out of the blue, these people have been fighting to change their legal statuses for almost two decades, and they've been trying to do it legally through the courts, through the systems. And unfortunately, now it's arrived at this situation in which their statuses have expired. But they do plan on continuing to do this legally, and they have held protests. I went to one in Tel Aviv in Habima Square. It was really incredible. Lots of music, lots of singing and dancing, and it was really beautiful. And I think that, you know, they'll continue to protest. And something that I was told is we know how to protest. We've done it before and we'll do it again. And I think that also goes to show how strong the testament is to these people and their story and them being here and how important it is to their identity. So I don't think they're going anywhere.
I noticed that they've just launched a new website, which is offering Israelis guided tours to get to know the Black Hebrew community. I mean, they've been here for close to 50 years and Israelis still don't know them.
Yeah, I don't think that most Israelis are familiar with this community, and I don't want to generalize, but from my experience living here, the Israeli public is not really familiar with a lot of its communities on the fringes of society. Not to say that this is on the fringes of society, but the Israeli public isn't that familiar with its minority groups. And I think also I haven't seen a particular interest in fostering a true multicultural society. So the Black Hebrew Israelite community is far from the first minority group to be marginalized by Israel, and it's far from the first minority group in Israel for the public to not really pay attention to what's happening to them and not really care. We saw maybe a year or two ago when the children of Filipino caretakers were being deported, it was kind of a similar issue. The public didn't really take interest. They didn't really care, despite the fact that these kids grew up here. Some of them served in the army, and there's a lot of overlaps in the stories between them and the Black Hebrew Israelite community, and it seems to be things unfolding kind of in their own echo chambers, which is really sad.
And in terms of the popular protest, were there many Israelis at this demonstration that you went to?
So It was definitely the most diverse crowd I've seen in Israel. And I don't think it was because the crowd naturally rallied so much solidarity with the public, as opposed to this is just a diverse crowd. And, you know, something that was beautiful was I did see a lot of classmates go and support, which is beautiful. And I did notice there were a few kids of Filipino caretakers that were there. There were some, you know, Ashkenazi Israelis that were there, so it was nice to see, but I was expecting the protest to garner a much larger crowd and much more solidarity among minority groups in Israel who know what it is like to be discriminated against the state for religious reasons, for minority reasons, for ethnic reasons, and I didn't quite see that, but I also don't want to say that it didn't exist there.
Well, maybe if Tide the Goat get some radio airplay with his new song, then it will raise consciousness. Listener, we're going to put a link to Shana and Daniel's interview with Tide the Goat in the notes to this episode. It's well worth a read. Shana, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Listener, another jingle, and we'll be wrapping up today's show with Adrian Hennigan. Welcome to part three of Haaretz Weekend, and welcome back to Haaretz.com's reviewer-in-chief, Adrian Hennigan. How are you keeping, Adrian?
I'm good, thanks, Simon.
So, Adrian, after your last visit here last week, we got a few messages from listeners asking about black space, not complaints, asking specifically about black space and Israeli TV shows in general. So I thought it would be a good idea to ask you back to tell us the best places for people who don't speak Hebrew or who want to go beyond Fauda to watch the many, many Israeli hit shows that have been produced in recent years. Where should they be looking?
Okay. Can I just circle back a little bit? It's funny because I first came to Israel in the late 90s, and so occasionally I'd sort of flick on the TV, and I couldn't quite believe how bad Israeli television was. It was like I'd gone back to the 1970s, and every show was either some horrible live music show, or it was news, or it was talking about news. And so to then fast forward to where we are now, where there's this incredible wealth of Israeli television is, you know, just such a transformation. But in terms of where people can access it, I guess it's a couple of things. A, if you're in Israel and you don't have Hebrew, like myself, because I've only been here 13 years, you know, give me time. And then, you know, Yes English is a good place to start. Mm-hmm. That has English subtitles of the main Yes shows, like Fauda. And Shtizel, of course. And then we have the international audience on places like Netflix, Apple TV. And in America now, it's really interesting because it's become this real strata of streaming platforms that need content and recognize that Israel has a lot of interesting shows. It's almost like there's a Premier League, which I think it's fair to say people like Netflix, Apple TV, HBO, HBO Max, they can really buy whatever they want. But then there's so much interesting content that actually there are then shows that people like Topic can pick up. Topic's like quite a small, really niche platform that looks at international programming that is like quite smart, aimed at an older audience. Well, over 25, so I count that as quite young, but and so there's like literally you have, as long as you know where to look and you don't mind paying, which is a lot of people, you know, it's very rare you'll find someone who only has one subscription nowadays. You know, you have to have two or three, and so if you're prepared to spend a little extra, then there's a lot out there.
We've certainly come a long way since the days of Zeuze and Lemon Popsicle. How did Israeli TV get so good?
That's a good question. I'm sure a lot of people around the world are asking. I mean, it's funny because when we talk about Israeli culture, historically we talked about film. I mean, Lemon Popsicle put Israeli film on the map for all the wrong reasons. And, you know, for years and years, it was film that dominated. And in the same way that everywhere else around the world, television slowly started being recognized as more than just, you know, the idiot box in the corner, Then in Israel too, they realized that actually you don't need a lot of money to make good television. And so if you think about the great Israeli shows that started in the 2000s, someone like Betty Poole was literally two people in a room talking.
Mm.
So the cheapest drama, and it was fantastic because A, that story in itself can be translated to anywhere in the world. I mean, I think Betty Poole, which HBO picked up and made as in treatment, must have been remade more times than any other show in, certainly in Israel, but I'd be amazed if there are many around the world that have had so many remakes. Like, you can go Hungary, you know, India. It's one of those shows because it's like such a simple idea.
Mm.
I guess it's Betty Poole and Hatoufim were the two game changers.
Mm. Hatoufim became Homeland.
Became Homeland, but not that you would reckon. I mean, that's the great thing. When you watch Hatoufim and you watch Homeland, you would never really guess you're actually watching the same program.
Mm.
And Hatoufim is a lot richer, and it's really character, 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 whereas Homeland became a genre piece. But it showed that actually the two could live side by side, and there's a lot to be gained by watching both.
We seem to have moved away from the stage when Israeli TV shows were nothing more than remake fodder, right? I mean, now they're airing Israeli shows in the original Hebrew.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the Netflix revolution, really. I think when Netflix came along in the, let's say, in the mid-2010s and really recognised that, you know what, there's all this great programming that is just going to waste. I mean, I guess it started with the programmes like The Killing in Denmark, which started playing in Britain, and people were like, oh, that's interesting. This is amazing. And I don't mind the subtitles. Then Netflix said, you know what, we can give you that and you can watch with subtitles, or we'll dub it very badly for you and you can watch it that way. And so Netflix really transformed the market. So nowadays, an Israeli show, on the one hand, can say, you know what, someone can remake this, and also someone can show this. You know, you look at, I guess, something like False Flag is an interesting one, because, you know, based around that most Israeli of ideas, an assassination in Dubai, I think, you know, the Hamas guy in 2010, became a big hit locally, False Flag, and sold to Fox International and showed in like 170 countries around the world.
Wow.
And now Apple is remaking it as Suspicion with Uma Thurman, and it's kind of one of its big shows for hopefully later this year. So, yeah, in a way, they're getting the best of both worlds now.
Mm. Are Israeli TV producers now mainly producing for an overseas market, or are they still looking at the tiny domestic market?
I think they're smart, and they realise that, if you like, what we call a tiny domestic market is this great Petri dish. Now, people want to see that something works, and actually what producers here will do is they'll make something that works for a local audience, but it's the idea is strong enough that it will just translate anywhere in the world. So you look at the Hindi market is amazing, because they will literally take an Israeli show like Your Honor and remake it shot for shot, more or less. It's remarkable to see how it translates almost verbatim, and, you know, obviously with a few cultural differences. Producers here are smart enough to recognize that Israel alone won't give them, you know, the careers they need to feed their families. So they're looking, they're co-producing with others, and it's very much what works here will work elsewhere, and they've now got a rich catalogue of shows that prove that.
And it doesn't sound, you know, given the variety of shows, I mean, we've talked about the thrillers, and we've talked about the gritty inner city violent things like Fauda and so on, but there are also a lot of pretty good comedies out there. So it doesn't seem to be a case of finding a formula, but rather tapping into something that translates literally and figuratively.
Indeed. I mean, that comedy was always the thing that in the industry people say comedy never travels. You know, Adam Sandler is probably ironically the only person who disproves that, because his humor isn't based in wit. But, you know, it's like shows like Stockholm, for example, which is on topic and is like a very warm, smart comedy. So you can see the original version. Germany has just remade it. German comedy, there's a thing. And it just shows you that nowadays, you know, nothing is off bounds. I mean, I think Israeli television is still quite genre-driven. Mm. I mean, what Israel as a country is reflected by its television. So you'll see a lot of shows set on an army base. You know, Hamefakedet is the latest example of a hit,
right,
that reflects that.
And right, which is dismissed, I believe, yeah, in the remake.
Yeah, well, that's how they're selling it as an international thing. And it'll be interesting to see how that, if that picks up an audience overseas, because I think it plays a little bit younger. And I think most Israeli shows that sell play to an older audience, and the ones that play a bit younger get remade. So an example would be Euphoria, which was, oh God, I mean, I found it difficult to watch here because it was so, so small budget. And when you're trying to present, you know, the emptiness of youth and like, and the, you know, this drug-ridden life, actually, you do need a bit of a budget to not make it completely depressing. And the HBO version just transformed it into this glitterball version of misery.
Adrian, for someone who's never seen an Israeli TV show before, where should that person dive in? Straight with Fauda, or maybe something a little lighter just to ease themselves into the genre?
I would always say start with Hatufim. It's not light, but it's such an amazing story, and it is such an Israeli story. And I would say start with that. I mean, Fauda is fun, but you can't take it seriously. It is very much a genre story, and I'd hate to think that people think that is the real Israel, but it is fun. And it also showed that Israel could actually do things that aren't just two people in a room talking. You can have two people in a room punching each other as well. But yeah, Fauda, I like Fauda. But I think what's going to be interesting is what happens next with like almost like the Fauda generation, because people who worked on Fauda did a show that aired earlier this year on Keshet called Line in the Sand, Hashotrim. Obviously not a direct translation,
yes.
But that's been a big hit here. It's just sold to four countries, places like France, Germany, Australia, and they've just commissioned the second season, presumably on the back of that international interest as well. Because you know, overseas audiences, if they're going to watch something, they want to invest. If they're enjoying it, then keep making it. I mean, Fauda, I wonder if Fauda would have been making its fourth season now if it weren't for the success it had on Netflix, because generally in Israel, shows tend to have a two shows and you're out rule. No, Shtizel, again, was two seasons and that was going to be it here. And then they had the big hit on Netflix and then back for the third season.
Right, giving them a new lease of life and
budget.
And budget to feed into future productions as well.
Yeah.
Adrian, I'm afraid we're out of time. Thank you so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
Thanks to Shani Littman, Shana Oppenheimer, and of course our producer, Aaron Ehrlich. We'll be back again on Monday with another episode of Haaretz Weekly. Until then, Shabbat Shalom from Tel Aviv.